Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone phone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Dr. Messner, please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Krista, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. And today's workshop is being conducted in collaboration with the Gastric Cancer Foundation, and you'll be hearing more from them during the program, and we're delighted to be partnering with them. Now, today's program is supported by Taiho Oncology, Inc., a grant from Genentech, and made possible through an independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program today. Now, I just want to acknowledge to everyone that we have over 200 participants on this program today, and you come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Lithuania, Nepal, New Zealand, Romania, and the United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call, and we're delighted that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us to learn more about advances in the treatment of gastric cancer. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Geoffrey Ku. And Dr. Ku is medical oncologist, head of the esophagogastric section, gastrointestinal oncology service, assistant attending physician, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Ku will be addressing an overview of gastric cancer, including diagnosis and staging, current standard of care, including chemotherapy, new treatment approaches, and the role of targeted treatment and immunotherapy, and precision medicine predicting response to treatment. It's now my great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. Ku, who'll be addressing these topics. My esteemed colleague, Dr. Ku, who'll be addressing these topics.
Thanks very much, Carolyn, and it's always a pleasure to be with everyone on this program. So it's really my distinct pleasure to kind of start us off on the discussion about stomach cancer. And, you know, as an overview, this is an uncommon cancer in the U.S., but a very common cancer around the world. And we think that that's really because one of the main risk factors for developing stomach cancer is a stomach infection called H. pylori or Helicobacter pylori. H. pylori literally affects half the world's population, 4 billion people, and it does increase the risk not only for ulcers, stomach ulcers, but also stomach cancer. And because H. pylori is relatively less common in developed countries like the U.S., and we do see less stomach cancer here in the U.S. But nevertheless, you know, about 25,000 patients every year are diagnosed with stomach cancer. And the symptoms that lead to it being diagnosed tend to be relatively nonspecific, meaning that it could mimic reflux, it could mimic having an ulcer, it could even mimic something like food poisoning. So it's generally not uncommon for it to take a couple of months to make the diagnosis. But ultimately, the most important component of diagnosing stomach cancer would be with an endoscopy. And this is a procedure where a tube is inserted from the mouth into the esophagus, the food pipe, and into the stomach. And if a mass or tumor is seen, that's biopsied, and that gives us a diagnosis of stomach cancer. Once that diagnosis is established around the same time, we would also consider imaging studies to figure out the extent of the cancer. Almost certainly this would include a CAT scan, a CT scan with intravenous contrast. Frequently we also use a PET scan, which injects a radioactive dye to see where the tumor cells may be. And then depending on the stage, we sometimes consider an endoscopy with ultrasound called an endoscopic ultrasound. And frequently a surgeon will also perform a procedure called a diagnostic laparoscopy, where a patient goes into general anesthesia. The The surgeon makes tiny incisions in the abdominal wall, and she or he then inserts cameras into the abdomen to look around to make sure that there's no spread of the cancer to the lining of the abdomen. Ultimately, based on all the staging or testing, we then determine the stage of the cancer, and the treatment options are then dependent on the stage. So certainly the much more favorable situation is that if we either have a very early stage tumor for which surgery alone is the only required treatment, or a middle stage tumor where the cancer or the tumor is bigger and may have spread to some of the lymph nodes around the stomach, but has not spread elsewhere. In that middle stage situation, the standard of care would consist of surgery. But typically here in the U.S., we also give chemotherapy both before and after surgery, and all of this is with the goal of completely curing the cancer. The most serious situation is if the testing reveals that the cancer cells have spread to a different location, in other words, if we're dealing with metastatic stomach cancer, in which case then we would focus treatments on reducing symptoms related to the cancer, on shrinking the tumors in a CAT scan, and on significantly prolonging a patient's lifespan. Now, I would emphasize that along with our regular treatments, especially now because we're still in the midst of flu season, RSV has been particularly bad this season, and there still is, you know, a COVID-19 infection present, I certainly would encourage everyone on the call to receive age-appropriate vaccination, including COVID-19, including seasonal influenza vaccines. And for anyone who's 60 or older, there are now vaccines against RSV, which is another kind of virus. So focusing a little bit more on the treatments, I already mentioned that if a tumor is middle stage, in other words, it hasn't spread, the tumor itself is relatively big and some of the lymph nodes are involved, the standard of care consists of chemotherapy with surgery, and that really is, that remains kind of the most modern and up-to-date treatment. On the other hand, if the cancer cells have spread and we're dealing with stage 4 metastatic cancer, there are now numerous other treatments that we would add in addition to chemotherapy. Chemotherapy works by killing cancer cells, which grow quickly, but it does also affect other cells in the body that grow quickly, including blood cells, cells of the intestinal tract, hair cells, and that relates to some of the side effects of chemotherapy. Now, for many patients, we are able to add newer medications that work in a different way, but when added to chemotherapy, make the treatments more effective. Now, there are a variety of different treatments. Certainly, some of these treatments include immunotherapy. Immunotherapy drugs are drugs that stimulate the immune system, so the immune system wakes up, recognizes, and attacks the cancer cells. And for many patients, adding immunotherapy to chemotherapy is a very appropriate option. But ultimately, how we figure out whether immunotherapy or some of these newer medications are appropriate is really based on the idea of precision medicine. And that term encompasses the idea that we try and understand as much as we can about a patient and about the cancer cells so that we can give a treatment that is most appropriate to them and uniquely suited to attacking the cancer cells. So in order to be precise and figure out which treatments are most appropriate, we rely on what are called biomarkers. And biomarkers, for the most part, are additional proteins that are found on the cancer cells that we can test. And based on the presence or the absence of these proteins, we can then figure out whether adding something to chemotherapy is appropriate. So there are four kinds of biomarkers that are currently tested. And certainly, you know, those on the call don't have to, you know, remember all their names, but it is important to make sure that you discuss with your oncologist to make sure that biomarker testing is performed. But biomarkers that we look for include a protein called HER2, includes a series of proteins called mismatch repair proteins, includes a protein called PD-L1, and then actually there's a new protein that has an odd name. It's called Claudin-18.2. And again, in each of these cases, either having the protein be present or be absent makes it then appropriate to add immunotherapy medications, to add a medication called trastuzumab or Herceptin, which blocks HER2, and then also with regards to this new protein called Claudin-18.2, there is a drug called zolbetuximab, which is, again, another long name, for which the FDA is currently evaluating, but we do hope that it will be approved soon so that it can be added to chemotherapy. So in sum total, Once a diagnosis of gastric cancer is made, we first have to figure out what the stage of the cancer is to determine whether surgery is appropriate in the event that it has not spread. If it has not spread and surgery is appropriate, we then need to figure out whether we also need to add chemotherapy to the surgery to further increase the chance of cure, or whether surgery itself is sufficient if the tumor is very small. I would also point out that there actually are even newer techniques, and some very experienced gastroenterologists are sometimes able to just scoop out the tumor from the inside with an endoscopy if we are truly dealing with a very early stage tumor. Early stage tumors tend to be uncommon in the U.S. because by the time patients have symptoms, they typically are middle stage or unfortunately even later. And then finally, if we are dealing with a late stage tumor that has spread, again, the goals are really to reduce symptoms from the cancer and ultimately to lengthen the patient's life. In that situation, chemotherapy is standard, but in addition to chemotherapy, we would look at adding newer medications. And in order to add newer medications, we need to perform what's called biomarker testing to kind of guide treatment. The last thing I would mention is that in addition to the four proteins or four groups of proteins that we test for that I just mentioned, there is also a complementary test called mixed generation sequencing. And mixed generation sequencing involves not looking at proteins, but actually looking at genes within the cancer cells. And there are many companies that perform this testing, but these companies look at up to 500 genes within the cancer cells. And the idea is to try and identify a weakness or a dependency of the cancer cell that we can then target also with some of the newer targeted therapies and newer experimental therapies. And Dr. Sombol will talk about this in the next section, but certainly something like testing the genes, mixed generation sequencing to test the genes of the cancer cells is very important because that sometimes can open up very innovative and very helpful experimental options for patients. So with that, I think I'm running a little bit ahead of time, so I'll stop there and certainly happy to take questions later on in the discussion section.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Koo. That was really an outstanding presentation covering so many important topics, and I know there are questions for you, as you've indicated, for the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Sonbal, Dr. Mohammed Bassam Sonbal, and Dr. Sonbal will be addressing the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment options, controlling treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain, the importance of communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns, and guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, follow-up questions, and discussion of open notes. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Sonbal.
Thank you, Carolyn. Appreciate it. I always appreciate and excited always about joining this program every year. First of all, I'm going to talk about the role of the clinical trials and how research contribute to treatment options. In general, I think patients always hear about clinical trials, studies, phase one, phase two, and other terms. So the question is, what does all of that mean? And that's what I'm going to focus on in the next few minutes. Now, you listen to the nice review of the treatments and the diagnostics from Dr. Koo covering all these landscapes. And the changes that has happened in gastric cancer. But how did we get here? How did we get to these targeted therapies, biomarkers and all of that? We really got here because of research and the work on research. And what happens is, if we follow the journey of any drug that comes in to the clinic, it all starts in the lab where scientists work on a drug or a compound. And if that drug looks promising, meaning if it works, if they find that it works and kills the cancer in test tubes or animals, that's all what we call preclinical research, then we take this drug and we study it in small number of patients. And studying that drug in a very controlled manner in a small number of patients. That's what we call a phase one study. So all what phase one mean is that this is a promising drug that's being studied on patients with cancer, and we want to know more. We want to know what is the dose that we can achieve, in which we can get the maximum benefit and lowest possible side effects in these patients. Now, if we find out that dose and we find out that the drug is tolerable for patients and it's actually promising and maybe have some benefit, then we take it to what we call a phase two study. And phase two study means that we're going to administer this new drug in patients who have a specific type of cancer, in this example, gastric cancer, and we're going to see if that would work in these patients or not. If so, if what we saw in the phase one study translate into what we call the phase two study. And then if that's positive, meaning that actually very promising, we see good effects, then we take it to the final test, which is what we call phase three study. Phase three study, most commonly, it's testing that new drug compared to what's currently considered the standard of care. Now, if we find out that the new drug improved outcomes, meaning that patients are now living longer and the cancer is shrinking more and things like that compared to the standard of care, then this new drug or the experimental therapy is now considered the new standard of care. So that's what's meant by phase one, phase two, phase three studies and things like that, or clinical trials is the other term that's used. So as I mentioned, I mean, each one of these drugs that you heard about today and these developments really got here to the clinic through this type of mechanism and got here because of patients like you who participated in trials and because of the altruism of these patients. Now, of course, in addition to choosing the right drug for patients and things like that, we want to make sure that we're controlling the symptoms of patients in general. So this is a big part of treating patients with cancer. And this will get to the next topic, which is controlling the treatment side effects and symptoms in general. Now, overall, the symptoms that patients with gastric cancer can have, they can be attributed to either the cancer itself or side effects from the treatment. Now, it's important to remember that big part of the symptoms that patients have are really driven by the cancer itself. And sometimes I tell patients, that if we're starting treatment, you're probably going to feel better on the treatment. And they seem surprised when they hear that. But then, a month or two later, they come in and say, actually, I do feel better compared to before. And this is all because, some of the symptoms, as I mentioned, are really driven by the cancer itself. For example, some patients say that, they have lost significant amount of weight or their appetite is they don't have much appetite. And that's really because we've learned over the years that, cancers can produce hormones, they're also called cytokines, that can affect these aspects. They can affect, the weight, they can affect the appetite. And a lot of times, if you treat the cancer itself, you're treating these symptoms, and that, the patient will feel better later on that. And in addition to that, the location of stomach cancer can be a little bit higher up, where it's located between in the connection between the stomach and the esophagus. That's it. The other term for that is gastroesophageal junction cancer. Sometimes if that happens, then that can interfere with patient swallowing. So if you treat the cancer and you give, for example, chemotherapy or other therapies, the cancer might shrink, and that can lead to improvement of the swallowing. Now, sometimes if the swallowing is not improved, then your doctor might ask a gastroenterologist to go down with a scope to kind of open things up, and sometimes they put something called a stent to help with the swallowing. And sometimes, for pain, for example, your doctor might refer you to palliative care doctors. Now, palliative care here is not to be confused with hospice. Palliative care is really what it is. Their group of specialists the group consists of doctors, nurses, social workers, and other members who help you in taking care of the symptoms while being treated for this type of cancer. Now, I mentioned how symptoms can be derived from the cancer itself or can be from the treatment itself. Now, For the treatment, we have examples, as the chemotherapy or immunotherapy in general, they can cause nausea and other symptoms or diarrhea. And the advancements that you hear about that happened over the years are not just in treating the cancer itself, but huge advancement have happened in developing new drugs that help controlling the symptoms. So for example, the anti-nausea medications we have, whether oral or intravenous, right now, they're very effective. And it's actually not a common thing to hear, a patient calling saying they're vomiting all around. This is, if I hear a patient calling saying, they're vomiting continuously, then we usually, think, okay, what's going on? Because that's kind of not something expected with the newer anti-nausea medications we have. And it's important to remember, in symptom management in general, that to treat the symptoms and treat side effects and all of that is really triggered by the communication that's, between you and your doctor. So it's always important to keep that open communication. And I always tell patients, remember that if your doctor or the healthcare professionals, if they're not hearing from you, they will assume that everything is going well. So if you have any concern, please let them know so that they can work on these concerns and work on these symptoms in general. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is telehealth and how to prepare a list of questions, quality of life concerns, and things like that. Since COVID-19 started in 2020, virtual visits via video or also known as a telehealth has become much more common. These visits have great advantages. I mean, they help facilitate some of the care and help avoiding travel, exposures, and things like that. At the same time, they're not always, appropriate. So it's important, first of all, when you're thinking about a video visit, first of all, ask yourself, is this visit appropriate to be virtual or not? Meaning, if the symptoms that you're having are severe enough that you think that need to be evaluated by your doctor or healthcare professional, then maybe if you need an examination, maybe a face-to-face is more appropriate. And then the other thing is also remember that sometimes your doctor or the healthcare team, they, after hearing your request for a virtual visit, they might not feel that it's appropriate. Again, it's based on the complaints that you have. Also remember that some of the regulation and policies regarding virtual visit have changed. So it's not some of the restrictions now are applied. They were not there before. Some of the restrictions were relieved because of the COVID-19 and now they're back on. So each hospital has its own policy on allowing or not allowing, video visits in general. Now, if the visit is appropriate, then try to be prepared. It's like the normal face-to-face visit. Try your best to have, a list of questions that you're going to ask your doctor about. And also, when you start the video visit, it's always important to remember that, choose a quiet environment that you're connecting from, and also try to introduce whomever you have in the room just to protect your own privacy in general. And of course, remember, it's always important to be on time. And with that, I want to try to be on time here, and this would conclude my part of the presentation. And thank you very much for listening.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Sonval. What a great analogy to make between the timing. Thank you so much, and a wonderful presentation, stellar, and actually, I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Stacey Hirschman, is Diana Bearden. And Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian, the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center, and discussing nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are essential in the tolerance to treatment and your quality of life. Your diet might be modified throughout your cancer treatment to assist with managing side effects such as decreased appetite, reflux indigestion, feeling full quickly, nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, and even weight loss. A dietitian can provide your individual calorie, protein, and fluid needs along with giving you information on how to modify your diet. Each person responds differently to treatment. We need you to communicate with us as you experience changes so we can help support you as quickly as possible. The goal, nutritionally, is to avoid any unintentional weight loss. Weight loss can result in a reduction in lean muscle mass. It can impact your immune function, increase your weakness, and increase your risk for falls. It can even delay wound healing and possibly delay your treatment. Even if you're overweight, you can still become malnourished. When nutrition needs are not met, the body uses protein from our muscle stores for energy. And muscle is responsible for our breathing, swallowing, chewing, and just day-to-day life activities for caring for yourself and enjoying your life. If you're struggling with eating by mouth, your treatment team may talk with you about a feeding tube. Now, this is a temporary intervention. It's not something that lasts forever typically, but it can give you an alternative route to meet your nutrition goals and hydration needs during your treatment so you can stay as well-nourished as you can. There are medications to help with side effects, so please talk with your healthcare team if you're having any symptoms arise. The sooner the better. If you're experiencing side effects and you've been getting medication for those side effects, mark down how you're taking the medication and communicate that with your healthcare team. Sometimes there are some specific guidelines about how and when to take medications to have them be more effective. Maintaining your hydration is essential. Dehydration can actually increase the feelings of many of the side effects that I've listed earlier. And fluid is anything that's liquid at room temperature, such as water, milk, sports drinks. And a general guideline is most people need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day. Some treatments, such as radiation, may require you to increase your fluid intake, but talk with your healthcare team about your unique needs. In closing, there are several members of the healthcare team dedicated to you, and we want to help support you. So please reach out to us as soon as possible as you notice any changes in how you're feeling or how you're responding to treatment. I'm going to hand the line back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Bearden. That was really an amazing call, and I know that that your presentation always lends so much information to our participants, so thank you so much. Thank you. Thanks. And our next speaker now is Ms. Stacey Hirschman, and Ms. Hirschman is Executive Director of the Gastric Cancer Foundation, and she'll be discussing the Gastric Cancer Foundation's free programs and services, and we'll provide you with links to their website and to how to contact them as well. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Hirschman.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you to all the presenters. We're always thrilled to partner with you to offer information through these workshops. I have to say, I always find it both useful and inspiring to hear about the progress that's being made. It's an important reminder that there's hope, and I always believe that hope is such an essential part of this cancer journey. I'm going to be very brief because we really offer this workshop to allow you to both learn and ask your questions, so I don't want to take up too much time. I want to encourage everyone to visit our website, which is gastriccancer.org, to learn more about our full menu of programs and services, but I'll just highlight a few. Research is a big focus of our operations, and we've granted over $3 million to promising projects, but I want to highlight the Gastric Cancer Registry, which gives patients and caregivers, family members, an opportunity to really be part of advancing research. You'll see the link on our website, and it is very simple to enroll, share your information, arrange for a tumor sample if you've had a biopsy done, or contribute a saliva sample, which is very easy to give, that the registry can then sequence and learn a lot that can drive new research and the effort to find better diagnostics and treatments. Dr. Sanbal mentions the importance of clinical trials. It is the singular path to approving and making new treatments available. But we find that too many patients are not made aware of the potential benefits of incorporating clinical trials into their treatment planning. And so many trials actually fail for lack of enrollment. Clinical trials can be very confusing. So we offer a free, unbiased, no pressure, no obligation, truly, clinical trials finder through our website to help patients and families learn about open trials that match with their individual diagnosis and disease state. I encourage you to check it out. Other resources, our website itself is chock full of information and links. And if you sign up for our newsletter, information will be delivered directly to your inbox. We're right now involved as a partner in a major educational campaign called Test Your Biomarkers to share more information about the importance of biomarker testing and the value it can have in getting the best and right treatment for your individual cancer. You can access that through our website as well. We offer a safe, confidential online community exclusively for patients and caregivers. So if you are one of those individuals, I really encourage you to check it out. It's a safe place where you can ask questions, share information, have very candid conversations with other people who are on the same journey and who really understand what you're going through firsthand. The link, again, is on our homepage. And last but not least, I want to mention our nutrition support program called the Gesundheit Kitchen. Gesundheit meaning good health. You don't have to sneeze. It is a wonderful resource for patients and families who want tips on how to live and enjoy eating after treatment, and most important, to get the nutrition that you need. I encourage you to visit our website and take a look. Hans Ruffert, who is a gastric cancer survivor and a professional chef, hosts these sessions with a licensed dietitian, and I think that you'll appreciate his spirit, humor, and optimism along with the information that he shares. So that's just a sampling of the things that we try to provide and that are available to you at no charge. So I'll just end by thanking everyone again and saying that no one needs to face this diagnosis alone. There is help available, and I urge you to take advantage of all that is out there for you.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Hirschman. That was really outstanding, and it's a wonderful resource for all of our participants. If you haven't visited the kitchen that they have, that is fantastic. It is a wonderful resource for all of you, and also the Trial Finder, and just so many things that they offer. Their sense of community and all that they offer. So please do take advantage of the Gastric Cancer Foundation. And now I'm just going to say a few words about cancer care services, and then we'll go on to the Q&A. So I would just like to say a few words about what cancer care offers. I'm Carolyn Messner. I'm cancer care's Senior Director of Education and Training. And cancer care offers a host of free programs and services. I'm just going to go over a few of them with you. So we do offer financial, practical, and co-payment assistance. And many people contact cancer care calling our HOPE line, 800-813-4673. And people throughout the United States do use that number to contact our oncology social work staff. We have about 40 oncology social workers, and they answer the phone. And so usually they call with a particular question. Perhaps it's for practical assistance or financial assistance or co-payment assistance, or perhaps it's a chance to talk with an oncology social worker about some of their concerns and questions. But the social workers do answer the particular questions that people call about, but then they also then move on to, the social workers move on to addressing all the different questions that people might have. Services that we might offer. So we do offer online support groups, and we offer them on gastric cancer and on many different types of cancers as well. We offer support groups for caregivers, for older adults, for younger adults, for middle-aged adults. We also offer support groups for those who are living with a particular type of cancer, perhaps gastric cancer. And we also offer support groups, online support groups for people who are living with being a caregiver, so caregivers for all different types of cancer. And we do also offer coping circles, support network for people who wish to participate in these programs. We offer free education programs. Again, all of our services are free, so free educational programs. And we also have publications and booklets as well. And of course, a very active website. So with that being said, you have a sense of some of the services we offer, and you can visit our website to learn more about all the different programs and services that we offer. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. And I'm going to ask Krista to explain to all of you how to pose a question in our question and answer period. Krista?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So this is a question actually for Ms. Hirschman. Can international patients join the registry? I'm a U.S. citizen living abroad. Question for Ms. Hirschman.
World, and yet the answer is yes. Use the link and you will be connected with someone at the registry and they will assist you.
Excellent. And then a question it's a question for Dr. Koo. Is it possible to remove a blockage without surgery?
I'll try and answer that question, but I was going to say that I learned something today. I didn't realize that Gesundheit meant good health, so that certainly makes sense. I think to answer the question, it really depends on where the blockage is. I think if we focus on kind of the beginning and the ends of the stomach, you know, there can be blockage at the point where the esophagus transitions into the stomach, what we call the gastroesophageal junction, and that would manifest as food getting stuck kind of in the middle of the chest. The other area where food can get stuck is at the end of the stomach as it enters into the small intestines, and that symptom would manifest as someone getting full very quickly, becoming nauseated, having bad reflux symptoms. In both instances, patient would lose a significant amount of weight. So the answer is yes. I mean, I think one way that we could try and relieve the blockage without surgery is by putting in what's called a stent. A stent is kind of a piece of bare metal cylinder. And what it does is that really pushes outwards and pushes against the tumor and kind of creates an opening so that food can either get from the esophagus into the stomach or from the stomach into the small intestines. That's considered really a temporary solution, but it does allow us to restore nutrition without surgery so that we can then consider other treatments, including chemotherapy, radiation, and maybe ultimately surgery to try and definitively take care of the blockage so that it doesn't come back.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And a question for Dr. Sondal. How does gastric cancer impact fertility? Is it still possible to get pregnant after a total gastrectomy?
Yes, it is possible. I mean, the way it can be affected is if, the patient got chemotherapy, for example. Some chemotherapies can affect fertility. So it's always a good idea to kind of discuss those things with your doctor specifically. Now, of course, we don't want, for example, while the patient getting chemotherapy, we don't want the patient to get pregnant because that can lead to some, more complications and some consequences. So it's always, when you're thinking of that, it's always important to discuss with your doctor about these aspects.
Excellent. So how does a gastric, so this is a question for Dr. Ku, how does a gastric cancer diagnosis affect risk of esophageal cancer?
That's a good question. I mean, they can potentially be related in that, like as I mentioned, you know, one of the main causes of stomach cancer is H. pylori infection. Now, H. pylori infection, you know, in and of itself does not increase the risk for esophageal cancer, but cancers that are at the beginning of the stomach, which could go up into the esophagus. So sometimes we use the term esophageal cancer, gastroesophageal junction cancer, and gastric cancer interchangeably. But one of the main risk factors for developing cancer in that location actually is having reflux. You know, there are, you know, millions of people in the U.S. alone that have reflux, but in a very small minority of people, what happens is that acid contents from the stomach kind of go up into the esophagus or the junction, and in a very, very small minority of people, that can eventually lead to esophageal cancer. So potentially, that would be the relationship. But to answer the question in another way, if someone's had, you know, gastric cancer and they've completed all the treatments and the gastric cancer is, you know, is cured, then the risk of developing a second or separate esophageal cancer, I mean, that to me is something that would be a rare situation. But acid reflux does increase the risk for gastric cancer at the beginning of the stomach and in the esophagus.
Excellent, thank you. And for Dr. Sunbel, should I be concerned about complications if I need to have an endoscopy? I know it's used for screening, but I am concerned as it is a medical procedure.
Yeah, I mean, endoscopy in the U.S., just to mention, it's not, we do not screen for gastric cancer in the U.S. It's mostly in East Asia, but it's used for diagnostics here, for diagnosing the cancer. Now, usually when it's recommended, I mean, the benefits outweigh the risk. Yes, there are some, you know, rare complications and rare issues that can happen, such as, you know, issues with the sedation itself, and anesthesia if the full anesthesia is needed, issues related to, you know, bleeding when biopsying. Extremely, extremely rarely the risk of perforation. That's extremely rare. I would say in general I wouldn't really worry about these things, but these are things to discuss with your doctor for sure, to kind of discuss the benefit versus risk. But again, this is for diagnosis. We do not use for screening. The difference between diagnosis and screening. Screening is to take a patient who does not have any symptoms and just do a scope on them to look for things. Diagnosis meaning that person has a problem. They have problem swallowing. They have, you know, acid reflux or things like that, and you're doing the scope to find out what's going on. That's the difference.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. And for Dr. Ku, what is the difference between intestinal and diffuse adenocarcinomas?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, it's a very technical question. So there are different ways. So gastric cancers are what we call adenocarcinomas, which are cancers that arise from glandular tissue. I mean, most cancers, breast cancer, lung cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, they're all adenocarcinomas. But when it comes to gastric adenocarcinoma, they can have different appearances under the microscope. And one classification uses the terms diffuse and intestinal. So they do appear to be different under the microscope. But more importantly, you know, we talked a little bit about precision medicine and biomarker testing. The results of the biomarkers actually are quite different between diffuse and intestinal. So certainly for me, that just makes me more attuned to the fact that we need to know the biomarker status, because that definitely has strong implications in the event that the cancer cells have spread. It has less implications if we're dealing with an early to middle stage tumor, where again, the treatment really consists of surgery with or without chemotherapy. But in the more advanced setting, knowing whether it's diffuse or intestinal, and knowing the biomarker status is really very important.
And a question, Dr. Sanval, does curative care always involve surgery? Are there any medication, chemo-only treatments for curative care?
The general answer is yes. Now, a cure's definition, but by that I mean is to, you know, to the cancer is all gone, and we do not see any evidence of the cancer on imaging, and the cancer hasn't come back within, you know, the accepted range is about 5 years. Now, in general, we say that cure is only achieved by surgery. Some of the medications might be changing this equation. So, and that's a kind of a think of, you know, one of the things of that we, you know, debatable usually. By that, I mean, you know, about 3 to 5%. So maybe 1 out of 20 patients of gastric cancer, they have changes that you heard about the MMR biomarker. So they have changes, what we call MMR deficient or MSI high disease. You heard that from Dr. Koo. So these patients respond, majority of them respond to immunotherapy. And when they respond really, really well. And some of them, they respond well to the point of, you know, they have prolonged responses even after stopping these medications. So there are some reported cases, you know, in the literature and actually, you know, anecdotally, I have patients, whether gastric or colon cancer, who went beyond 5 years and they don't have any evidence of the cancer coming back. Again, that's not the general, you know, we cannot generalize that, but this is something that might be happening with some of these new medications. And again, not everyone is eligible for immunotherapy, and those responses, it does not happen. They do not happen in everyone. They are more profound in those MSI high, MMR deficient cancer, gastric cancer patients.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks. And I hope that helps our participant. The next question for Dr. Koo, are medium chain triglycerides something that you would recommend for someone who has undergone gastrectomy?
Yeah, I don't know whether Ms. Bearden is on to answer that question or not. That really is more a question for her. I would say that in general, I mean, it's not something I would recommend. I mean, I think the basis for the question is, you know, in someone who's had part or all of their stomach removed, you know, what are the nutritional issues to be aware of? And I would say that the remarkable thing is that certainly when someone has only had half their stomach removed, the remainder of the stomach, the small intestines, they really compensate very well, you know, to help people to absorb, you know, things like carbohydrates, proteins, sugars, but also even other nutrients like vitamins and minerals. And that, I think, is also similarly true when someone has had a total gastrectomy, although in that case, you know, we certainly have to be aware of vitamin deficiencies. The vitamin deficiencies that come to mind the most are vitamin B12 and vitamin D. And in general, even in our patients who have undergone total gastrectomies, I've not frequently seen a nutritionist, you know, recommend supplementation with specific fats or even proteins. Patients may need vitamin B12 and vitamin D supplementation. We certainly recommend, you know, smaller, more frequent meals. And there are certain food intolerances that may develop. But I think my answer would be no. We certainly don't recommend fatty acid supplementation on a regular basis.
Thank you. And for Dr. Sanval, should biomarker status be taken before any chemotherapy? Is it too late to have the marker status measured if chemo has started?
No, I don't think it's too late. I think everyone should be tested for these biomarkers. Now, definitely biomarker testing, as you heard from Dr. Koo, I mean, it helps us choose which regimen to start with or which regimen is the most appropriate. But is it wrong to get started on chemotherapy if a patient really needs to be started as soon as possible and then wait for the biomarker testing and change things. No, it's not wrong to do that. You know, more as you heard, I mean, the majority of the patients will probably need chemotherapy. The minority of the patients are the ones who will end up on something that does not need, you know, chemotherapy. Now, the exception to that is, you know, sometimes I get requests from, you know, my navigator is getting a call from a patient interested in getting an opinion here and interested in clinical trial, and their, you know, their doctor is about to start them on therapy. Then I tell them to hold off on starting therapy till I see them, because you have to take that into consideration that a lot of clinical trials in what we call the frontline setting or first-line setting, when they want patients to be involved in a clinical trial, they do not allow any doses of chemotherapy before getting on the study. So that's the only exception. But in general, clinically speaking, in the clinic, there's no problem with getting started on chemotherapy while awaiting some of the biomarker testing to come back. And all the biomarkers you heard about, or actually the three of them, you know, the MMR, the HER2, and PD-L1, they're all done, you know, most big centers do them locally. And when done locally, usually the turnaround time, I mean, you get the results within 3-4 days maybe at most. The claudin 18.2, it's not commonly done now in tertiary centers. Only few tertiary centers have it, but it will be in the future. So my point is, a lot of times these tests will not take like 3 or 4 weeks. The one that takes long is the other one that you heard about from Dr. Ku, which is the expanded testing, the next generation sequencing, which is the gene testing. That needs time. Yeah.
Excellent. This is a question actually for Dr. Ku. For a chemo surgery, chemo treatment protocol, is it possible to determine if the patient is cancer-free between the three stages after the first chemo treatment?
Oh, so I think, you know, when we say that someone is cancer-free, or indeed when we use the term that they're cured, you know, frequently it's a retrospective diagnosis, meaning that the technical definition is that 5 years has elapsed since the start of treatment before we declare that someone is cured, because beyond that 5-year period, the chance of the cancer coming back is very, very low. So for that reason, while someone is in the middle of treatment, I mean, it's very difficult, potentially impossible to say, you know, that the cancer is gone. And that's even true if the patient has chemotherapy first, they then have surgery. And actually for some patients, when they have the surgery and when we look in the part of the stomach that was removed, we actually find that the cancer has completely disappeared. In other words, that the chemotherapy was so effective that the cancer was eliminated. But even then, it's very difficult for us to say that the cancer is completely gone, because there could still be microscopic cells floating around in the bloodstream, which is part of the reason that we also give chemotherapy after the surgery. Now, I mean, there are additional tests that we can do, including scans, and, you know, there's a new test where we can look in the blood to look for cancer DNA. And, you know, if we don't find cancer DNA in the bloodstream, that's, of course, a good thing. But it's difficult to say with 100% certainty at this early stage, you know, that someone is cancer-free or that the cancer is completely gone.
Excellent. And another question for Dr. Sanbal. Is gastric cancer passed through families?
It can. Gastric cancer can be hereditary, meaning that you can inherit something from your parents and put you at a higher risk of developing gastric cancer or others. So it was important we always take what we call a family history, so we kind of take the family history and discuss with the patient, based on the family history, if there is any need for doing the genetic testing. The genetic testing here, it's really done on the things that you inherit from your family, so that's different. That's what we call germline testing, which is different from the testing of the genes of the cancer itself. Typically, if I have a patient who have a family history, or they have, or the patient themselves, they have, multiple, this is not their first cancer, or they're the younger age, or they don't have risk factors, then I test for the genetic testing, the germline testing. It's usually either a blood test or a hair follicle. And then we kind of go from there.
Excellent. I actually want to ask our speakers just to present the takeaways from today's program. So I'm going to start with Dr. Ku, and then Dr. Sanbal, and then Ms. Hirschman. So Dr. Ku, just a takeaway.
Yeah, I think my takeaway is that, you know, stomach cancer is comparatively rare in the U.S. So I think it's actually really important that a patient and a family member, you know, seek out a hospital, an institution, and team, you know, that's very familiar with treating this cancer. I think the initial workup, the biomarker testing, all of that is really critical to identifying the best treatment option, you know, for the patient at that point in time. And I would fully emphasize that, you know, until proven otherwise, you know, the goal is always to try to cure the cancer. But certainly at every step along the way, I mean, you know, the goal is really to try and help, you know, reduce symptoms, make patients feel better, and certainly along the way provide psychological support, nutritional support for them and their family members.
Oh, thank you so much. And Dr. Sanbal.
Yeah, my takeaway is, you know, we've made a lot of advancements in the last, specifically last 5 years or so in treating this cancer. And definitely a lot of these advancements are really attributed to patients' altruism in participating in clinical trials. And I just want to say that, you know, that there is hope. Just remember that.
Excellent. Well, that's fantastic. And Ms. Hirschman?
Well, I think what I would say is this is not one size fits all. So every patient is an individual, and it's your job to be a partner with your care providers in making sure that they know what's going on with you and that you receive the best treatment.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all of our participants for your wonderful questions that you asked today, and I want to thank our speakers for also being so incredible in terms of this program. It really makes all the difference in the world. We've done this program before, but I have to say this program today was really outstanding in terms of both our speakers and our participant questions. I do want to remind all of you that you're not alone. I think that's been said before. There are now resources for you, and we want you to take advantage of those resources and be sure to take advantage of them. You have the Gastric Cancer Foundation. You have Cancer Care. And you have a community of support that are here for you. And please take advantage of them so you do not have to do this alone. And most importantly, I want to thank each of you for participating today. And I want to thank you all for your great questions. And I want to thank our speakers again for their terrific presentations. I want to thank you all and wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.